You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store.
Tonight's show is sponsored by The Barter House. The Barter House is proud to support the Heritage Radio Network and its community of food lovers. The Barter House works with family vineyards and small bottlers from around the world to bring only the finest and most flavorful wines to market. Committed to sustainable agriculture and artisanal production, The Barter House offers outstanding wines at a wide range of price points to retailers, restaurateurs, and private collectors. To learn more about The Barter House, please visit them on the web at thebarterhouse.com or call them at 917-463-3076. Welcome to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host. This is episode 93 of Why We Cook. And seems like I was in the top something iTunes podcasts this week. Top 40? Like Casey Kasem, iTunes Top 40. So that's really great. That's pretty cool. So whoever you are out there listening and making me rise up the charts, thank you. I appreciate it. Not the only Heritage Radio show on the iTunes Top podcast. Dave Arnold also of Cooking Issues is on there too. So Heritage Radio is ruling the virtual airwaves, the internet, the cloud. We're ruling the cloud. I've been off from work almost all of July. I go back tomorrow, but I've been off from my regular gig, my teaching job, for almost 3 weeks. I was on vacation, as you know. I was in Arizona, and then I did a couple of big food and wine events, which I've talked about, the one in Ohio and then Meatopia. I go back to work, like I said, tomorrow. But, you know, because of all that, I've kind of really gotten off schedule and sort of off my normal daily kind of life. And what that means, quite ironically for somebody in my field, is that there's no food in my house. There's like nothing to eat. There's yogurt. There's always yogurt and some peaches, which I bought last week. And there were a few dried up carrots, but like nothing else. No food. I'm a chef and a culinary instructor and a radio host who talks about food for a living, and I have no food. You know, the shoemaker's children kind of thing. I did buy a bunch of vegetables yesterday to use as props in a photo shoot that I did today. So I'm going to eat those tonight. I ate some of them. I ate some of the props for lunch. I'm going to eat some tonight. And when in doubt, I always say, if you have no food in the house, eat a can of salmon. Always keep canned, wild-caught salmon in your house. Did you know that that's one of the rules sort of existence? I buy wild caught canned salmon at Costco because I won't eat farmed salmon anymore. And I keep it around. Canned salmon and duct tape. That's what you need to keep in your house. If there's ever an emergency situation, you can survive on canned salmon, and the duct tape will help you out with all the non-food emergency situations you might be in. So if you don't like canned salmon, you could use sardines too. But it's like the sort of like the 21st century fallout shelter mentality. Instead of keeping cans of soup, like maybe they did in fallout shelters in the 50s, I say keep canned salmon. And I had a teacher in college. I went to art school, and my first year I took a course, and it was called Media Communications. And she told us how the most important thing we should ever do is that when we travel, we should always travel with duct tape. I don't know what that has to do with media or communications, but it stuck with me, so to speak. So I've had no food in my house, like I said, except my breakfast stuff, because if you're a listener of this show, you know how religiously devoted I am to breakfast, and I always eat breakfast at home. So, you know, my quinoa, my eggs, my oats, my usual breakfast stuff. That's always around, and there's always milk for tea. I get anxiety attacks if I know that there isn't milk for my tea. I have gone so far as emailed my husband from Vietnam to say, make sure you get milk because I'll be home in 36 hours and there better be milk in the fridge for my tea. That's how bad I need my tea in the morning. But other than that, like the breakfast stuff and the milk and the fruit, most of my other food comes from my job in the form of random leftovers. And I've talked about this a couple months ago. I did a whole show on this. You know, there'll be like a half a head of broccoli or, you know, like a little piece of meat that somebody mangled in a butchering class. And yeah, you know, that could go to City Harvest. I mean, I could feed the hungry and the homeless of New York, but, you know, times are tough. So it comes home with me sometimes. And that's kind of how I do my grocery shopping. And I like to do that. I scavenge around. I get leftovers. And then I make new meals out of whatever I find. It's sort of like I live on a constant, endless episode of Chopped, where there's a box in front of me with stuff and I have to make food out of it. And that's like 75% of the food in our house, probably maybe even more, comes from that. And I haven't been teaching in 3 weeks, so we're kind of starving in my house. And I was thinking about that today. I was thinking about probably the money that I've saved over the years on not grocery shopping. And also because when you're a chef, you wear a uniform. And I haven't had to buy clothes. So the money I've saved on clothes and food, it's no wonder I live in palatial splendor in Brooklyn. But it also means I never learned actually how to like dress myself in a professional manner. So when I do have to look presentable, it can be kind of a problem. It's like I'm 10 years old and I need to dress myself like an adult, but it turns out I was raised by a pack of all-male wolves, and they never taught me anything except how to hunt for food. But anyway, so these past 3 weeks, I've been away. I've been on vacation. I've been doing these events, and I've been working at home, too, because I've been getting the new show ready, because as I've been hinting at for these past couple months, I will be relaunching the show mid-September with an all-new format, new name, new everything. And so I've been doing a lot of work on that, getting it ready. And when I'm working at home, I get hungry. I have to eat. And I don't have my normal access to food that I do at work. So what am I getting at here? What I'm getting at is that I was kind of digging around in the fridge trying to see what was in there other than the standard, you know, yogurt and peaches. And I found some peanut butter. It was like the little light from heaven like went, oh, like the clouds parted and a ray of light came down from the sky. And there was peanut butter in the fridge, and it was the natural kind of peanut butter, the kind that you squirt out of the peanut butter making machine at the health food store or at, you know, Whole Foods or someplace like that. The kind that I often buy and then forget that I bought, because I don't have actually sort of have the opportunity to eat it that often. I don't really like eat it for breakfast, and I don't make sandwiches, but I like to have it around. So when I do buy peanut butter, that's the kind that I buy. Like, there's no Skippy, there's no Peter Pan in my house. No, 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 no. I buy the natural kind of peanut butter, and then I keep it in the fridge. Because peanuts are, as we know, very high in fat. Very good fat. It's good for you, good for your heart, all that stuff. But those are fats that are very unstable at room temperature, and they go rancid. Nuts go rancid quickly at room temperature. Those are very unstable fats. And so you want to keep your peanut butter cold. Keep it in the fridge. Keeping your peanut butter at room temp would be like if you bought a stick of butter and left it sitting around in a jar at room temp for 2 years. You wouldn't really want to eat that either, would you? It would go rancid also. No, it's food. You should keep it cold. You should preserve it. And actually, you know, back to that whole survival thing, like I was saying, the 21st century fallout shelter idea is, you know, you could keep peanut butter around, too, because even if the power grid goes down, it'll be okay. It won't be as fresh, but it'll keep for a while. So you could have peanut butter. Let's say you're a vegetarian and need your emergency food shelter. Although, really, if the world is ending around you, are you going to stick to your principles and stay a vegetarian? Probably not. You're probably going to wind up killing your pet and eating it, or your neighbor, or if you get really hungry, something like that. But you could keep peanut butter around, too. It's a good emergency staple. So you should probably keep a jar of that around with your sardines and your canned salmon, too. And then you can sit in the dark and eat it with a spoon while the world goes to hell around you. Or maybe in the freezing cold, depending on the season. You should probably keep some chocolate around, too. because if you're really scared as the world is ending, the chocolate will make you feel better. It'll comfort you. And since the world is ending, you could eat as much chocolate as you want. You could just like shove it in there. And don't be afraid, because remember, you have duct tape also. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more about survival and peanut butter. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by The Barter House. Welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host. Remember that you can find me on Facebook at Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. On Facebook, you can become a fan of the show. Send me comments, questions, criticism. I can take it. You can also follow me on Facebook at Chef Smarty Pants. And I've been getting a lot of, what did I just say? You can follow me on Twitter. Did I say Facebook twice there? Maybe. Yeah, Jack's nodding. Twitter, that's what I mean. I've been getting a lot of Twitter followers lately. It's kind of cool. I only tweet once a week, though. I don't believe in abusing the tweet. One a week is plenty. I don't care that your dog is, you know, laying on his back or that you're sweating. Like, let's be conservative with our tweeting. Anyway, so I was talking about peanut butter and surviving in a post-apocalyptic world and duct tape. And, you know, something you had to keep in mind about peanut butter. Oh, yeah, because I found this peanut butter in my fridge that I forgot I had. And I forgot how much I love it. But, you know, it should be made from peanuts. Now, that seems obvious, right? But you'd think, like, all peanut butters are just made from peanuts. But yet again, those evil industrial food giants have taken something perfectly good, a one-ingredient product, and destroyed it by adding all kinds of crap to it. So products like Skippy, Jif, Peter Pan, if you look at their ingredients, it says peanuts, and then the second ingredient is sugar. And then the third ingredient is usually hydrogenated oils, and then sometimes there's mono and diglycerides in there too to keep them from separating. The irony is that they put the mono and the diglycerides in their so-called natural style peanut butter because people don't want the oil floating to the top. So you're buying the natural style peanut butter, which actually has chemicals added to it, more so than the regular style. If you just keep it in the fridge, it won't separate. But there shouldn't be ingredients in peanut butter. There should be just ingredient peanuts. That's all it is. I don't understand why we have to add sugar to everything. Does everything have to be sweet? I guess so. I once was reading this whole story about somebody who's one of the development chefs for IHOP. And he was talking about developing new menu items. And he said that when they do their market research, they have these test panels that come in to taste. And they cannot make the food sweet enough for the tasters. The one criticism the tasters have is that things just aren't sweet enough. Like, they can't add enough sugar to that. It's like they're like crackheads and they just can't get enough. It's crazy. So I used to teach a lot of recreational classes. Now I just teach in our professional division, but I used to teach a lot of Southeast Asian, Thai, Vietnamese, that kind of stuff. And I always had the students make peanut sauce because we either did like a satay or a summer roll or something that needed peanut sauce. And the peanut butter that we would get at work was kind of like the government surplus peanut butter that they feed to kids in cafeterias. The government seems to think of our kids as like a repository or a dumping ground for surplus corn and corn sugars and seed oils that they can't feed to animals. So they mix that stuff into all the other commodity products that they dump on the school system. So they feed them this commodity peanut butter that's full of corn syrup and hydrogenated vegetable oil and corn oil and, you know, all that shit. And it's basically the cheapest possible peanut butter available. Now, where is Michelle Obama when we need her? She's supposed to be championing the new school lunch, but oh yeah, she's out praising Walmart. I forgot. So anyway, I won't use that peanut butter that we use at work because it's just not, it's not good. It's not good stuff. So what I do is I have the students make their own. Now, you would be amazed at how totally gobsmacked, dumbfounded people are by the simplest things. Like the fact that you can make your own peanut butter really, really easily blows people's minds out of the water. Or that whipped cream doesn't have to come from a can, or that popcorn doesn't come from a microwave, or that lemon juice doesn't come from a plastic bottle. All of those things. But peanut butter seems to just blow them away. So here's how you do it. You take peanuts, roasted, unsalted peanuts. You could use salted if you want. And you put them in a machine, like a food processor or a blender. And you turn it on. And then you walk away, and then you send out a tweet, or maybe you text someone, or you like you water a plant, or you look in the mirror and sort of contemplate your face for a while. Something like that. Pee. And then you come back to the machine and peanut butter. It's amazing. It takes like 3 minutes. That's all it takes. You just turn it on. That's it. You walk away. You come back. You have it. You could add salt if you wanted to add salt. That's fine. What you can't add is sugar or corn syrup or whipped up vegetable oil bonded with hydrogen. That's not allowed. You can't add it. That's against the rules. If you want that, just buy a jar of Skippy. Then you take your artisan-made, your artisanal, handmade, Brooklyn-style peanut butter, and you put it in the fridge. And you use it up fairly soon. It'll keep a while, but it won't keep that long. And then you can also make peanut sauce out of it. Peanut sauce is a really easy thing to make, too. You take something spicy, a little Thai red curry paste or a little chili paste. You put it in a pot. You open a can of coconut milk. On the top of the can of coconut milk will be thick coconut cream. Take a little bit of that. Mix it with the spicy stuff in the pot and start cooking it until it stops spluttering and the paste gets a little dark. Then throw in the rest of that can of coconut milk and simmer it till the whole thing thickens. That's it. Then you season it. Little fish sauce, little soy sauce, lime juice, little palm sugar, maple syrup. Boom! Thai peanut sauce. That's all there is to it. So simple. That will actually last in your fridge probably until the next Asian Lunar New Year comes around, which is probably in February. That'll keep a long time because you've cooked it. Now, one other thing is like if you're looking for peanuts to make this peanut butter out of, if you're going to do it yourself, try to find Valencia peanuts. You know, there's different varieties. There's Spanish peanuts and Virginia peanuts. And then there's Valencia, or as they would say in Spain, Valencia peanuts. Try to find those. Because Valencia peanuts are less likely to be contaminated with something called aflatoxin. Aflatoxin is a mold that causes liver disease in people who ingest too much of it. And it's present in all peanuts in teeny amounts. But Valencia's seem to have the least aflatoxin. There are some people who are now avoiding eating all peanuts and peanut products because of aflatoxin, but I think that's a little extreme. I mean, I like peanuts. They like me. You know, they're an old friend that get lost for months at a stretch in my big fridge, and then I find them, and it's like a happy reunion. I'm supposing if you're eating peanut butter or peanuts 3-4 times a day, you may run the risk of developing liver cancer from that aflatoxin. Apparently, in countries where peanuts are consumed in huge amounts, like parts of Africa, they have higher rates of liver cancer. But, you know, this is America. You're going to get liver cancer from almost everything else. So I don't think the peanut butter is really going to do too much damage. We're going to take another really quick break. When we come back, I'm going to change the subject completely.
Better be a break you are. Hey girl, when you gonna let
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show sponsored by The Barter House. More information at thebarterhouse.com. Welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host. I just took a bite of pizza. Sorry. So if it sounds like I'm chewing, I am. And that's probably not so pleasant for you, but I got hungry. Sorry. Been living on peanut butter all day. So, as I'm sure you're aware of, if you're in New York or not in New York or pretty much anywhere in the U.S. except for maybe like Seattle, we had a massive heat wave last week. I don't think you could have missed it. And on various days or at points during that heat wave, power usage in New York reached the historical maximum level. Like, we used more power on Friday than we've ever used in New York. And so they started doing these like little brownouts where they would drop the power level down in certain neighborhoods. Not like a true blackout where the whole system goes down, but like where the power company says, okay, less power for you. And they did that on Friday night. It was like 117, 150 or something on Friday night. And we kept trying to turn our AC on and it kept blowing the fuses in our apartment. So we sat in the dark with a fan on. It was funny because it felt like a blackout, but it wasn't really a blackout because we were watching Weeds on Netflix, but we had the fan going and we were sitting in the dark. So sort of a semi-blackout experience. But as I was sitting there, I was thinking about everything in my fridge and what would happen to it if we had another full-blown blackout like the one we had in 2003 or the one we had in 77, which I actually remember because I'm that old. Not that there's much in my fridge, as I started off the show talking about. But at work, I had just prepped 75 pounds of braised short ribs and 50 flank steaks that I butterflied and trimmed and then rolled up around that 75 pounds of short ribs and tied up. And those were from Meatopia. And I packed them up and I put them in the fridge at work. And then I went home and came home to rolling brownouts and thought, holy crap, what if the power goes down at school? There goes my 125 pounds of meat that I need for tomorrow. I'm not sure what I really would have done, except I guess I wouldn't have done Meatopia because I would not have had any meat. And I couldn't really do like Vegetopia. It wouldn't have been very popular. But the refrigeration lasted the night. The meat survived. We made it safely to the pier. And then we stood in the raging hot sun on the concrete pier like people on a giant human pizza stone with no tent over us for 8 hours while we served meat to 1,000 ravenous New Yorkers. But it was still really fun. We had a great time. It was a good event. If anybody was there, I was there at the Creekstone booth, but they spelled my name wrong, so you might not have even known it was me. But it was still pretty good. Next year, though, how about some tents? I'm not really sure who made the decision not to tent the entire event, but if you are an organizer, you're involved, you know who's in charge of Meatopia, tell them next year tents would be really great, really awesome to be under tents. But enough of that. So tonight, when I get home from doing the show, because it's a live show, I'm going to cook up all those vegetables that I bought for the photo shoot. So today I was up on my roof shooting new headshots for the new website for the new show, which you'll see in a few weeks. And I had all these vegetables that I had bought that I wanted sort of scattered around as props. And so I was thinking about what I could make, and I thought, oh, perfect. I can make succotash. I think it's time for succotash. What is succotash, you may ask? I may have talked succotash once or twice before on the show in the summer. But succotash is like this perfect summer dish where it's sort of based on corn. Always has corn in it. It's corn that you saute or you kind of simmer. And then usually there's some kind of bean in there. And usually tomatoes are added. Now, it's traditionally a Native American dish from North America, from New England. Which means that tomatoes didn't come into it until probably later on, because tomatoes came up from Central and South America. But corn and beans, definitely sautéed, some tomatoes. But there are a lot of variations on a succotash. Generally, you cook it with either lard or bacon fat. Although after Meatopia, I have to say, like, enough with the bacon fat. I'm done. I'm going to use olive oil tonight. Sometimes it has a crust. Like sometimes people bake their succotash with a little crust on top, which sounded really good too. Now I have all this stuff from the shoot. I have all this corn and some radishes and a whole bunch of carrots. And I also have a big bag of frozen green beans, which seems a little silly now that we're right in the middle of the season, but that's all going in my succotash. And it's cool because it's the kind of thing you can throw together a big batch of it, cook it, then throw it in the fridge, and then you can eat it for the rest of the week. You can eat it hot. You could eat it cold. And since in my world, everything tastes better with an egg on it, tomorrow I'm going to have a big bowl of succotash with a couple of eggs poached on top of it. I'm already looking forward to that because really eggs make everything better. I know a lot of people say everything's better with bacon, but I say everything's better with eggs. And I'm also going to throw a whole lot of red onions in there too. So I'm going to saute those up, get some color on them, get them nice and caramelized. Throw in the corn, same thing. Then I'm going to put in the radishes and the green beans. Now the carrots, I'm not so sure if they're going in the succotash or not. I think the carrots are going in a slaw. I think I'm going to make a carrot slaw tonight. On Sunday, after recovering from Etopia, I went to a family kind of barbecue thing, and I was served the most horrendously disgusting carrot slaw I've ever seen in all of my many years in the food world. So this carrot slaw was so bad, and it made me so upset and offended that I sort of, like, I feel the need to balance out, like, the karmic carrot wheel, that, like, something really bad will happen in the carrot world if I don't make amends for that. I didn't make it. It was bought. But it was grated up carrots mixed with mayo and raisins, which doesn't inherently sound that bad. I mean, it sounds gross to me, but it doesn't sound like it would be that bad, and, like, I would potentially eat it. But this was so bad, it was, like, inedibly bad. I think it was from Walbaum's. And, like, seriously, why would you buy a pre-made deli salad from a place like Walbaum's? It was held together. I don't even know if it was mayo. I don't know what they used in there. It was more like, grout or that, like, epoxy silicone stuff you used to seal up tile, maybe. That's sort of what it tastes like. Anyway, but my carrots are going to be lovingly shredded and dressed with some kind of really nice vinaigrette. And I'll put whatever else I can find in there, some herbs or something like that. And then they'll take their place alongside the succotash on the table, and all will be right again in the vegetable karma universe. I feel like I need to make an offering to the vegetable gods after that. And then I'm going to sit with the lights on and eat my succotash and my carrots. Knowing full well, though, that if the power goes out, I have a can of wild salmon and a roll of duct tape right at my fingertips. So we're just about out of time. So thanks for listening to Why We Cook. Thanks to Jack in the control tower, as always. And stay tuned. Big changes are coming very soon.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. Removing barriers to better quality locally raised meats is one step further along the process. The Niche Meat Processor Assistance Network, or NMPAN, is connecting people across the country with information, tools, and each other. The organization is part of the Cooperative Extension Systems Extension, an internet-based collaborative learning service that consolidates the resources of the land-grant universities. The NMPAM affiliates are now available in almost 40 states and allow the co-coordinators to link people who need help with those who can offer it, such as extension staff members, state departments of agriculture, and markets with experience in small meat processing. They offer webinars, business plans, and hands-on help for processors or wannabe processors. More information is offered at their website, www.nichemeatprocessing.org. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
Finger on the Pulse and City Winery are proud to present the Summer Barbecue Blowout Festival, August 6th, from noon to 4 p.m. The barbecue is happening at City Winery, located at 155 Varick Street in New York City. Restaurants featured at this event are Empire Mayonnaise, Van Dag, Momofuku Milk Bar, Imperial No. 9, Mile End, Mexi-Q, Kraft, Dizzy's Club, Coca-Cola, The Meatball Shop, and Dos Toros. Providing the soundtrack for the day are Midnight Magic, Pewter Magic, New Villager, Punches, Ducky, DJ Autobot, and the Snacky Tune DJ. VIP and general admission tickets are available at citywinery.com. Finger on the Pulse of City Winery, we'd like to thank our sponsors: Heritage Foods USA, New York Magazine, Reka Vodka, Sonar, Smile, Guilt City, Sub-Zero, and Wolf. Please come out and join us for a day of fun, food, and dancing. For more information, go to www.fotpnyc.com.